Hello and welcome to episode 2 of Data After Hours. I'm your host, Eric Bolish, and I'll be taking you on a journey into the world beyond the data. Today, we're joined by Amanda Mikulik, the Executive Director of the Data Visualization Society, which aims to foster a community that supports the growth, refinement, and expansion of data visualization knowledge for members at all expertise levels. But tonight, we're not talking about data analytics. Instead, we're exploring Amanda's hobbies and interests outside the office. So grab your favorite after-hours beverage, settle in, and let's get to know the person behind the data. This is Data After Hours. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Eric. Thanks for having me.
Of course. I'm super excited to have you on as our second guest. Had a few bumps in the first episode with some mic issues, which we were talking about right before we got started here. But I'm really excited to have you and get to know you outside of the data analytics world.
Thanks. Yeah, I'm excited to have a conversation that doesn't center on why AI is going to kill the world of data visualization, which seems to be the topic du jour of the world of data analytics and tech these days.
Me too. So before we get into your hobbies, for all of our listeners, could you just share your connection to data analytics and maybe highlight some of your work with the Data Visualization Society?
Sure, I'd love to. So my roots are actually in public health. So I have my master's in public health, and I've worked on public health data and analytics professionally since I finished grad school in 2010 in various different capacities on monitoring and evaluation, health information systems. And I've gotten to travel to and work in more than a dozen countries around the world, primarily in sub-Saharan Africa, as part of that work. And so my full-time job is actually working as a consultant in the data visualization world, focused on public health data viz, specifically around building people's capacity to do data visualization work themselves. I really love taking on projects where the focus is on how to coach, teach, and train others rather than just going ahead and building a product or a deliverable and handing it back to somebody. So that kind of in the weeds, teaching, learning, and process piece, I get really excited about. I do volunteer with DVS, the Data Viz Society. We've been around since 2019, and I have been on the board since our start as first the operations director, getting all of our 501c3 stuff started out and getting some of those foundational systems in place, and then serving as the executive director. This will be the end of my tenure as the executive director this year. So we actually have term limits in place in the DVS bylaws. So I will finish my second term as the DVS executive director at the end of this year. And it has been a wonderful space to help see how our community has grown from the initial kind of fervor. We had, I think, 3,000 people signed up in the first 3 months of DVS for this tool agnostic community space to connect. We now have over 31,000 members in over 176 countries around the world, which is incredible. And exciting because it creates a space where we can connect and share knowledge and insights that span tech stacks and tools. And for me, it speaks to a lot of my roots doing data visualization in public health, where I was a public health data person first, where DataViz was a tool in my toolbox. And I think a lot of the times we talk about kind of data visualization jobs and roles as the end in themselves. We're going to build the dashboard. We're going to build the analytical tools. We're going to do these things. And for me, focusing on those kind of elements of creating demand for data, improving data literacy, and strengthening data use happens in part because DataViz is a great tool in that toolbox. And DVS creates that space for those conversations through everything from our mentorship program, through Nightingale, our journal that we have in both digital and print, and with Outlier, which actually Outlier 2024 is coming up in June in Chicago. And we're excited to dive into the theme of positive disruption in the world of data visualization. So I'm really excited. We finished a speaker review recently, and we had 176 different speaker pitches. And I kid you not when I say that even getting down to like a top 50 to fill 30-something speaking spots on the agenda was tough because there were so many great pitches with different facets around the kind of ways in which people work with and think about data. And it really focused for me on the kind of multidimensional ways in which we work with data and do things, which I think is kind of coming back to the focus of this podcast, right? Like we're all more than just the one kind of project that we put out there in the world and have all of these other interests and side projects and passions and hustles that we do outside of our full-time job.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So just two questions about DVS. I guess one's a question, one's a comment. When you started this, you said you had 3,000 signups, and now you're up to 30,000 members. Did you envision it growing like that? Or like, were you shocked when you're like, wow, look at where we are today versus where we started?
I'm really proud of where we are today, in part because we're still a volunteer-run organization. We don't have a single full-time staff member. We have some part-time paid contributors who support DVS in different ways. But I'm really proud of the growth and the programming we've built as the volunteer-run organization. I think the best testament to me of where DVS has been successful isn't in those big numbers. It's in the stories I hear about someone who met someone else through DVS that they never would have met otherwise. And that sparked some kind of professional collaboration or kind of working together on a personal project. And we've had multiple different examples of that that have been showcased in Nightingale and other spaces, where we talk about where those kind of one-to-one creative collisions have really had an impact. So, I mean, I don't know what I ever expected in terms of numbers and growth, but at the end of the day, I think it's about those kind of smaller scale connections that people make more so than any of those big numbers, as much as the big chewy numbers are nice to have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's the one thing that I love about the data visualization community is just how willing people are to help others and get involved. Mm-hmm. Like you said, just you meet people from all over that you never would have met because of this community. So that's what I love. And going to the Outlier Conference, last year it was in Portugal, right?
Portugal in Porto, yeah. Yes. So we started out in Europe. We did our first one in Europe. It was a blast.
When I was moving to the DC area, that was the first international trip I took by myself. I went to Portugal and explored. It's like, it's the only place I've ever like really been able to talk about. And so when I saw that it was there, I was like, oh, I'm so jealous. I wish I could go. And but yeah, I'm sure that was incredible.
We had over 200 people come in person. And I mean, Outlier, this will be Outlier year 4. The first 2 years were virtual only, thanks pandemic, and maybe silver lining, because we got to kind of get a structure and get the kind of overall feel of what kind of conference is this? What kind of talks do we do? We got to do that in a virtual space first, which is also a bit less costly. And now I've been able to build out this in-person event, which we're excited to kind of hop around to different locations. And this time, Chicago being pretty central for a lot of our US-based folks and having a great international airport for folks to come into. So I'm hoping that we'll sell out all 300 tickets that we have available for our in-person session.
Awesome. Well, I hope so too. All right. So moving on, outside of the time you dedicate to DVS, what are you doing for fun outside of data analytics?
Yeah. So I think that it's interesting thinking about the things you do for fun each week or each month. I was thinking about like the prep of coming on this and talking about my hobbies. And I think it's very good to be transparent and say I have two small children, one of whom is 18 months old and one is 5 years old. So I have two kids who are still in the need pretty intensive care and feeding mode of their lives. And so a lot of the things that I do these days really reflect the fact that I want to be inclusive and do stuff with my kids during my time out of work. I do spend a lot of time outside of my day job and outside of my consulting work, volunteering and doing work with DVS. I mean, to be transparent, that's 10 to 20 hours a week on a really regular basis, which is a pretty significant amount of time. But I found that like things we love to do on a regular basis around where we are in DC is to go be able to explore outdoor parks and museums. I love right now just like getting outside in all of the parks and spaces, taking walks, going and seeing all the flowering trees and other things that come out in DC in the springtime. If you're someone who lives in DC, you probably know about all the things that aren't cherry blossoms that grow here, the azaleas, everything else. I like to think that one day I'll be a better gardener and go beyond the container gardens that like little pots I have in the backyard. But I do really enjoy kind of spending time outside and getting to do that with my kids. From a broader perspective, though, like on a day-to-day basis, I love cooking. I actually volunteered at a cooking school in DC for a couple of years.
Oh, wow.
That was really fun. Got to learn some interesting techniques and approaches. It was a great gig that we could dive into a bit more. And I love to cook and make time for that. So I try to continue to make time for that, for cooking, baking, and some of my TV watching habits probably reflect that personal interest in terms of watching cooking shows and the Great British Bake Off and all those other things.
Oh, yes.
But yeah, I mean, there's those things you do every day that kind of like fill your cup in terms of spending time outside and getting out to parks and going ahead and spending time with friends, going out and having great dinners, things like that. And then there's the things you do that are a bit more infrequent, but are the things that are really kind of a great point to rest, reflect, and just kind of enjoy your life. And for me, travel is the big part part of that. Like, I'd actually never been to Portugal before the DBS conference.
Oh, wow. But
I'd been to a lot of other countries all over Europe and around the world. And so my husband and I made a whole trip out of it, left our kids with my parents, and actually spent 14 days traveling around both Porto and then out to the Azores. And that was amazing. So I really love traveling and getting to see the world, and have been fortunate to get to do that as part of my job, as well as more of a personal hobby. I think those are the big things that I focus on, thinking about getting outside, cooking, food, restaurants, all those bits, and then making that time for travel and seeing the world, which you can obviously see how those first things kind of feed into how I might spend my time when I'm traveling.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I think for my wife and I, that was the biggest thing that I wanted to find in a partner. You know, we met during COVID. And so it was hard. You know, we were always spending time at each other's place, and it's like, we just want to travel. And that's what I was looking for. Like, I wanted to see the world because I've never really been out before. We've done trips to Barcelona. We've done a few cruises. We have a big trip to Italy coming up. And, you know, for us, similar to what you were saying, food is a huge part of like our life. So anywhere we go, finding the best restaurants and just trying different cuisines, like the food is always like a very big highlight of all of our travels.
It's so fun. And I think it's been fun to, like, when you travel to different places, going to both like the places that make the lists and getting to experience really great restaurants, but also like, what's the local cuisine? What are the like local vendors, stalls, street food that you can eat? I mean, I was in Bangkok in August and it was a work trip, but I got to enjoy Bangkok a bit too. And like, we went out on Friday night to Chinatown and just like wandered around and hopped between different food stalls and got amazing Thai street food. And I suppose there's a bit of bravery in just kind of eating street food in different spaces, but I think that's also part of the local culture and what that looks like. And I will say, in a lot of my international travels, I think I've gotten sick more often from eating like hotel buffet food where fruit was washed improperly than ever from like street food or other spaces. But that food piece is so important, and it's such it's such an interesting part of kind of looking at patterns of where I've gone and where I've gotten to kind of be part of local communities where people invite you into their homes. That's one of the great parts of traveling for work sometimes, is your local colleagues inviting you over and getting to really experience what that local hospitality looks like. It's just so fun. And I'm salivating at some of the food in Thailand. It was so good.
Absolutely. Yeah. So for me, I am not a very good cook at all. So my labor of love is I do the dishes and I clean up and like I'll help prep stuff, but it's my wife that loves just finding a new recipe, and she's pretty good where like she can see a video and then she's just like, okay, I'm going to make that, and doesn't need a recipe. Where for me, I'm like, I need to follow a recipe. My timing is always bad where it's like, this is done before this and it comes out cold, but she's really good with that stuff. So,
I'm much more like your wife. Like, my husband jokes that he's like, you can look at a fridge full of leftover random stuff and somehow treat it like a chopped basket that turns into actually some like amazing meal. Like, he's like, I would just eat the same, like exact same thing from a Tupperware until the leftovers were gone.
Yep.
And you somehow make the same leftovers into five different things. But I mean, I think that's part of the joy of cooking, right? It's part of when I was working at the cooking school, or volunteering at the cooking school, it was great. You could volunteer there. You got to basically take the class for free, and your job was to clean off dishware as people were finishing with it at their stations and to re-pour wine. And that was basically your job. And then the chef at the end would make you a meal and you'd sit and hang out. But what was great was they had different kind of chefs focused on different ethnic cuisines. And I think that the Indian chef would spend like 30 minutes walking through all of the spices before we'd even start cooking. But you learn so much about like which spices bring warmth and heat and different kind of flavor profiles. That I think that mastering those kind of fundamentals, how do you build a sauce? What's a roux? How do you go ahead and do different chopping techniques? Helps me appreciate more when I'm traveling the fact that oftentimes some of the most delicious things you eat abroad are so simple, but made with such fresh ingredients and some like very specific technique or approach that's unique to that area that is just like transforms these seemingly simple things into something amazing. It's probably why I love watching Anthony Bourdain's show still, terms of a good thing to pull up on streaming if you need some good background noise to just hear the comfort of someone kind of diving into local culture.
Yes. Do you have a specific cuisine that you enjoy cooking the most?
Ooh, that's a good question. I love cooking Asian food, but that's kind of very distinctly broad and not very specific, in part because I think I like different kinds of Asian cuisine in different times. I mean, you can take like Indian food and narrow it down to regions, right? So I'm being deliberately broad when I say Asian, but I do think that the flavor profiles and like all the spices and the use of fresh herbs, especially in Southeast Asia, in Vietnamese cooking and in Thai cooking, are just so delightful in terms of their kind of interplay of salty and sweet and umami and spicy and sour, like the use of acid and lime and everything. Yeah. I love those kind of flavor profiles. And it's something I didn't grow up cooking as much. So I think it's been a more fun learning experience. I've actually learned a lot about cooking Asian food in some ways from my brother, who's lived abroad for a good chunk of his adult life, currently living in Indonesia as a scuba dive instructor and underwater photography expert. And he's someone who, like, when I've traveled with him or he's cooked different things, he's vegetarian. Like, I've learned a lot about building sauces and doing different things from him in terms of Asian cooking and Asian cuisine, just from watching how he approaches that. There's still somewhat rare occasions we get to see each other these days, given our kind of different living locations.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd have to agree with you. I think Asian cuisine has become my favorite. I didn't grow up an adventurous eater at all, but my wife is Vietnamese, so
I've been
introduced to a lot. Before we even met, I didn't even eat sushi, and she's like, what do you mean you don't eat sushi?
Have you gone to Vietnam?
No, not yet. That's on the list.
Gotta be on the list. It's such a beautiful country.
Yeah,
I would say too, before we move away maybe from travel specifically, or we could dive into kind of other fun adventures and travel, I will say that people often say, like, what's your favorite place you've gone to? Not just for food, but like, where have you traveled? And I still think I have such a soft spot and like a love for South Africa for a couple of reasons. Mm-hmm. One is kind of just the diversity of things you can do. You can safari and then go down to wine country and go drive the southern route that goes along the coast, and you can enjoy big cities and more rural environments. And it's just such a amazing space with such beautiful, wonderful hospitality. I also was privileged to be able to actually spend some time working there, where I was there for almost 2 months for a secondment. And my husband, my now husband, came at the end of that trip and we got engaged on safari. So I think that actually probably biases me a little bit to being really fond of South Africa, because I have such a fond memory of that in terms of thinking back to those pieces. And I like to think that we have kind of interesting, to your point on kind of couples and partners, we met actually sitting on a metro platform in DC, next to each other on a bench. And there was something affirming that after a year of dating, for our 1 year dating anniversary, where we're like, what should we go do together to like celebrate a year? Mm-hmm. His like initial pitch is, let's go to Iceland in January. But we did, and it was great, and we had a wonderful time. We went scuba diving in the Silfra Fissure. We got to travel around and see the geysers and enjoy parts of the island. And it's great to have a partner that wants to explore those kind of things with you. There's something really wonderful about that.
Yes. Yeah. That's been just one of the best things that we've been able to do now, is just travel and explore the world. And I can't wait to see where that goes.
But so, what's your favorite sushi roll? Now I have to know. Now that you eat sushi.
I don't know. I feel like, of course, I still eat the ones that are, you know, like still like fried, or like those types of ones that are like very safe for me, because I'm still not super adventurous.
Okay. But exploring is wonderful. Those hello bites. As parents, we talk about the hello bites, right? Yeah, like just like try the eel one time and see how it goes.
Yes. No, see, anything eel, like I love anything with eel on it. Like that's become one that I really enjoyed. But off the top of my head, like I love a dragon roll. Dragon rolls become one of my favorite ones that we've gotten. So, that was always a funny story for when we started dating. Now, you mentioned this twice. You mentioned scuba diving. Is there any connection to scuba diving that...
Is there a data connection to scuba diving? Absolutely not. I've been diving since I was a senior in high school. Wow. My mom actually has her PADI certification her scuba dive license from back in the 70s. Wow. So there was this decision we made as a family when we went to Hawaii my senior year of high school for my like senior trip. We each got to pick like a big senior trip, that we were all going to get scuba certified. So we did our kind of classroom work and our pool time practicing with the gear. In Rockford, Illinois, where I grew up, where most people go do their open water checkout dives, where you go from the pool into diving in open water. They'll do those in like a lake, which is pretty murky and not too beautiful. We instead went ahead and we did our open water dives for checkout dives in Hawaii, which was much nicer in terms of visibility and the things you could see. And I've been diving ever since then. I've done over 100 dives on 6 of the 7 continents, not Antarctica. Never done that. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you can dive there, even with a dry suit on. But yeah. I've done dry suit diving in Iceland. I've gotten to do a live aboard on the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. I've gone down and spent a week in Bonaire, where you do lots of shore diving. You gear mm-hmm. on up, sometimes mm-hmm. walk down lots of stairs to the reef, and then go out and just swim out to the reef because of where it is, mm-hmm. located just off the island. And it's such an amazing and wonderful experience to be able to have that sense of kind of calm and quiet and absolute overwhelm at the same time. I know some mm-hmm. people say, like, I could never scuba dive because I'm claustrophobic. And I totally understand that sentiment. And then on the mm-hmm. flip side, for me, I always have this feeling of overwhelm and immensity when you first kind of go down into the ocean, where it's mm-hmm. like, it just goes on for forever and you can't see the end. And there's mm-hmm. something really just kind of, I don't know, beautiful about that. And so it's been a great experience to get to see different parts of the world and different parts of the earth that you otherwise wouldn't get to. And makes me worry when you think about kind of the ways things looked on reefs and what that looked like. I mean, 20 years ago, 20 years ago, that's when I got certified, 20 years ago. So 20 years ago, what that looked like compared to now, because of issues around climate and temperatures rising and issues that that's creating for the corals. And it's just heartbreaking to think about kind of what's going away and what my kids won't be able to see in 20 or 40 years or in their lifetimes.
Yeah. Yeah, that's so true. I didn't realize, like, I think I've always thought about scuba diving because, you know, you go on vacation, it's like, oh, you can just snorkel here. But if you want to do the scuba diving, you have to go through this whole class. And so it's like, oh, we don't have time for that since we're here. But I've had quite a few friends get certified in it now. So it must be, I guess it's more popular than I thought. And I mean, I totally agree with you. I think it would take me a little bit to get comfortable just like having all the gear on and like trying to breathe underwater. But then at the same time, it's like, you are alone in your thoughts, just like getting to see something that you've many people don't get to see and just like take it all in. So I can imagine how that feels.
It's such a curious sensation. It also, I think it's good to be transparent about this too. I think it is a sport that is one that requires a certain degree of financial privilege. It's not an inexpensive hobby to take up, right? In terms of diving, even if you rent your gear, like having your own gear, going ahead and traveling to places that you want to go see and dive if you don't live in a more tropical climate, you can go diving anywhere. But like the really kind of the things you think about when you think of scuba diving are usually on a coral reef somewhere or something like that. And so I think that as we get older, that's also part of what you see is people having the flexibility to start to take on and take up these more kind of fancy hobbies. I don't golf. So, you know, we all spend our money in different ways. So I'll pick a dive resort over a golf resort any day if I'm going to go ahead and go on a vacation. But it is a beautiful way of seeing the world. And I think it's one that you have this community of people that all kind of have a certain reverence, from my experience, for nature and the natural world. That when we were flying to Bonaire, for example, which you only go to really if you're going to go diving. That's the only thing there is to do there. It's not a beachy, resorty kind of place. You go to Aruba if you're doing that. And one of the flight attendants on the plane actually said pointedly, she's like, this is the best flight. Everyone gets on. No one drinks a bunch or anything because you all want to die when you get there and you all just kind of fall asleep. And it is such an experience, including night diving, that gives you even more of that sense of alone, like being with your own thoughts, that I was pushed off the back of a boat basically for my first night dive with manta rays in Hawaii, my first like week of scuba diving out in actual ocean, because it was so terrifying to like jump into a dark ocean. But having done it once, I have done it over and over and over again, because it is such a beautiful experience to get to see a different set of creatures come out and just that like absolute sense of darkness that you have that I find just really calming. I don't know if that's about me as a person, but it's a really wonderful thing. I can totally understand that.
Yeah, I would agree. Maybe it's something I'll have to do in the future.
You should. I highly encourage. I would 100% recommend.
Will you get your kids into it if they're interested?
If they're interested, sure. I think it's always great to give kids the opportunity and say, like, here's something that mom and dad like to do. My husband's also certified to dive, that mom and dad like to do. And are you interested in doing that? It's fun to have it be a family affair that you can do together. You can't really start diving till you're 12, though. So I think we've got some years between now and when we'd start to go ahead and investigate that, just because of the complexities of managing your own air and everything else. So I think I've had a little bit of time to see. But I will say both are absolute water bugs. And the five-year-old especially is like, would this live in a pool and on the beach if he could. So I think that he has that kind of enthusiasm for water that maybe primes the pump a little bit for wanting to go scuba diving.
Cool. We'll have to check back in a few years.
There we go.
Awesome. Well, we are getting to time here, but I do have one final question, which is a question that I'm asking on all of our podcasts. And of course, there will be some data visualization element to this, but just a fun question. If you were out in the wild and somehow you had to fight a gorilla or a grizzly bear, which would you rather fight and why?
Ooh. Now you're sending me down my path of regret that I didn't go walking with the gorillas in Rwanda when I was there. I would pick the gorilla.
Okay.
I'd pick the gorilla. I feel like I have a sense that on the whole, if you're out in the wild and you see gorillas, people do go actively kind of trekking to go see and kind of observe and be kind and patient and keep their distance from gorillas. So I'd rather not fight one if I didn't have to. But grizzly bears seem like they could probably like destroy my face in about one claw grab. And so I feel like I would rather face off against the gorilla. But both sound rather terrifying if they're both in bad moods.
Yeah. I think Bo said that he would rather fight a grizzly bear.
Oh, so really?
We'll see how it pans out.
I can't wait to see. I'm so glad that we've already got a contrast in episodes 1 and 2 that we're not all picking the same answer. That means you made a good question because there isn't a universal sentiment. This feels like the 100 duck-sized horses or the one horse-sized duck question, but reframed differently.
I had to come up with something interesting, you know. So, well, Amanda, thank you so much for joining me on the show today. It was great to get to know you more on a personal level, and hopefully I'll see you sometime, you know, walking around DC, or maybe down in the reefs, scuba diving if I ever get there. But it was a pleasure having you, and thank you for a wonderful conversation.
Thanks, Eric. It's so great to be able to chat about fun, interesting things like cooking, scuba diving, travel, and all those things that we spend our time doing that are maybe the reason I don't spend as much time making public-facing visualizations for fun. Yes. Nice to get off a screen sometimes.
Yes, I'm with you. Well, of course, it was great having you. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in. Make sure to hit subscribe for more interesting stories from the data world. And join us next time on Data After Hours. Stay curious and good night.